Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys. That's right. Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two guys sit around and talk about genre, horror, science fiction genres in movies, television, literature, all the things. We talk about the key elements of those and how they've influenced us and influenced others. And my name's David. I'm here with Tim. Hey, Tim.
Hey, David. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. What have you been up to? What have you been doing?
Oh, I don't know. I'm feeling a little evil myself.
Evil? But don't you always, though, really?
I mean, seriously. Well, I mean, there's a difference between being devilish and being evil. So maybe I'm just being devilish. But yeah, yeah. And considering today's subject matter, I think it's appropriate.
Yeah. Evil's appropriate.
As far as stuff that's been going on here lately, a little while back, it's been a minute, so it may take me a second to acclimate. I revisited a film. God, when did it come out? I think it came out. It definitely came out this decade. Called House of the Devil. And you know, I should probably look it up because I really wasn't prepared to talk that much about it. It's a movie.
House of the Devil.
Yeah, actually, it's a little over 10 years old. It came out in 2009, and it's a relatively unknown director. His name is T. West, as in T.I. West. And basically, he goes at pains to recreate the remember the crazy movies of the 1970s where everybody was in a satanic cult? That's what this is about.
Yeah.
Kinda. It's got that great actor from one of my favorite X-Files episodes, Tom Noonan. Was in an episode of the X-Files called Paper Hearts. It's just an excellent episode where Mulder suspects that his sister was not abducted by aliens and may have indeed been killed by a serial killer. Anyway, he's in it. They go at great lengths to make this movie look like it was made around 1975 or maybe even a little earlier with the hairstyles. I would say 76 is probably a better bet. Anyway, it's just it's a groovy little movie, and we've been talking about films to do next year, and I was thinking about getting some devil movies in there, so maybe this one will make the list. I don't know.
Okay.
What have you been up
to? Interesting. No, I've never heard of it. I've never heard of it at all, so that sounds kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you reminded me. I loved all those cultish backlash against the hippies kind of movies of the 70s. You know, it was all like, you know, you're all going to turn into Mansonites or whatever, you know, sort of thing.
Right.
So, yeah, that's very true. I actually did two little things interesting. One, Westworld is back, so I'm happy. But I mentioned that last week, too, because it's back and that's good. But been deciding to, you know, read some new plays and look at some new theater works and everything else, and came across, just in browsing, one a couple of weeks ago that I ordered, and it was just called The Twilight Zone. That was all it was called. And I thought, well, you know, I've seen other ones before where they've done adaptations, you know, because so many of the Twilight Zone writers, you know, Beaumont and Matheson, all of them are really good at writing theater too. So a lot of those
it almost gives me deja vu. Like, did we not do something similar back in the day? I can't recall.
We didn't do it. I don't think we ever did a Twilight Zone, but I know we had talked about it a lot because, you know, some of them are so, you know, one set, but so. It just said a compilation of Twilight Zone classics. So I thought, okay, cool. Got it. Started reading it this week and thought, wow, this is really, really cool. Turns out it's only like 3 years old. It was written by Anne Washburn. She's a big playwright who's done a bunch of really cool plays and some neat stuff. She did the one that a lot of people are doing now, but called something about Mr. Burns. She did the Mr. Burns one, the one that's you'd like the premise. It's kind of a weird sci-fi p- post-apocalyptic premise, but basically it's post-apocalyptic, and somebody only has like one DVD left, and it the only thing on it that's still legible is one episode from The Simpsons. And then scene two is like 10 years later, and the DVD's not there anymore, so they're having to tell the story to each other. And the play goes through like 150 years of how this word-of-mouth story of The Simpsons ends up creating their own culture and changing the whole, you know, face of Earth.
Kind that of sounds really like a Black Mirror weird episode.
Yeah, sort of like that. But anyway, so yeah, I highly recommend this. This was pretty neat. They've taken two Matheson stories, a Beaumont story, and everything is like woven together. So like she'll take, you know, like, do you remember Shelter, the one that reminds us a lot of, Demon on Elm Street or Oak Street or...
The Monsters on Maple or...
Monsters on Maple Street.
Is that it? Something like
Shelter
that.
Yeah, that's the one-hour version of Shelter, which was like the half-hour version you did like season one or season two of Twilight Zone, where it's the same story. It's basically everybody's sitting around at like a garden party, and they're all making fun of the one guy because he's been keeping them up at nights because he's building a shelter. And then suddenly the televisions go out, and it's a... You know, incoming, you know, there's objects incoming, and the president says, seek shelter. And so he and his family go down in the shelter that they built, and it's about how the whole neighborhood starts going crazy trying to get in, you know? Mm-hmm. But she changes it and, like, makes two of the characters soldiers that had, like, just returned from a space mission that were in another episode. And then another family, instead of them being Jewish, are black. So it gives a lot of racial tension into it, too. It's really neat. It's a cool story. But anyway, I digress. I just highly recommend it. And it's simply called The Twilight Zone. And it would be cool to stage it.
It's a play.
So it is a play. Okay. Yes. And it was done in England. And I finally did some research on it the other day after I read it. And turns out that they actually had to change some things in it because when she was originally writing it, she was going, well, I can't do this story because everybody knows this story. Or I can't do that story because everybody knows that story. And then when they realized they were producing in England, not everybody in England knows the stories. And they don't understand it all. And there's like this fascination with that 50s style of writing and the way characters were written back then for television. You know, the bartender going, hey, bub, pull up a chair. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of that real macho Americanism that England didn't have.
Why I oughta.
So it was very interesting. Yeah, why you I oughta. You know. So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. But good stories. I may forward it to you so you can read it too. I think you'd really like it. But there's nothing in it that's demonic. So it doesn't bridge well to what we're talking about today. Which is, what are we talking about today, Tim? What's our topic for today for all of our lovely listeners out there?
Well, we're going to get a little evil, and we're going to travel mm-hmm. back in time a few decades to 1976 with Richard Donner's The Omen.
The Omen. Cue the music right now. Yeah.
Let me give you a brief synopsis, and then we'll go into some background info. Basically, this is a movie about an American diplomat. His name is Robert Thorne, who has a lovely wife named Catherine that in the very beginning of the movie, she loses her baby to a miscarriage or a bad delivery, whatever. They're in the hospital, and he opts not to tell her and instead adopts a baby whose mother apparently died. And that way, I guess you can see, you know, that both sides are going to turn out well because the baby has a home and his wife has a baby. But he does not tell her this. So she is led to believe that this mm-hmm. is her child. As the child grows older, he has become the ambassador to Britain. Turns out strange things start happening, beginning with the death of one of the child's nannies, suicide, actually. And as events, I won't go into too much detail, but as events unfold, we begin to believe that this child may, in fact, be the Antichrist, and he is not only surrounded with weird events, but could potentially be causing them. And eventually, Robert Thorne is convinced that this is the case, and he decides that he must be rid of the child before worse things happen. So, and I'll just leave it at that. When was the first time you saw this movie, David? Did you see it in a theater?
I did not. I don't think. I don't remember seeing it in theater, so I'm going to say I didn't. I'm going to say I probably watched it on VHS and rented it. But I do remember it being scary at the time. And in this rewatch, it's still scary. It's still got some good stuff to it. I really like this movie as a horror movie.
Yeah.
I would recommend it. Yeah.
It's old school. I'm trying to think of what the word is. It's got old school clout. It's got big money clout. The fact that Gregory Peck is the lead.
Definitely.
Gave it a lot of clout. But you can see the money in this film. There are some scenes that still ring true to me today that just stick in my mind when I think of this film. One of them is the graveyard with the dogs. It's clearly a soundstage, but it's beautiful.
I like the fact that they don't, go for the kill. As a matter of fact, one of my notes in this is, I thought the priest died a lot sooner. But he didn't. They give you this really, they do a great setup, and then it just gets, it's like a noose tightening. It just gets more and more tense and more and more tense and more and more tense, and you don't know what's going to happen. So it's well done from a suspense angle. I like that a lot. But they don't skimp on the gore. They don't.
Actually, there's not a lot.
Shy away from it either.
I mean, there's not a lot of blood. There's some shocking things that happen as far as deaths, but it's not a gory movie, I wouldn't think. I wouldn't say that. Would you?
No, I don't think it's gory, but I do think it has some overt violence that leaves an impression.
Yeah, it's got some memorable violence because they try to make the kills unique considering the subject matter. Yeah, for sure. The movie was directed by Richard Donner, who at the time was just a television director. This was his big break. He has since gone on to do a million things we all know and love, including the original Superman movie, Lethal Weapon, some of those kid movies of the 80s. Like, didn't he do Goonies or something like that?
He did.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, he's been around the block now. We also revisit our favorite composer, Jerry Goldsmith, who has done several of the movies we have covered on this podcast, who actually won an Oscar for this film with a score that is probably right up there with Psycho as far as being memorable. This music,
yes.
The minute you hear it, you know what it is.
Yeah, and I think, didn't it become somewhat of a cliche, too, in the 80s and 90s, the same way Psycho was? I mean, Saturday Night Live would use it. I mean, almost everybody could. Anytime you're thinking demons or Antichrist or the devil, and they would go into that, chorus chanting. It was like this big staple of, yep, that's Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah, I want to say that, and I could be wrong, but Amityville Horror used something that kind of reminded me of this, too. It may have been kid voices, like a kid choir.
But it was kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was more of a child choir, so it had that kind of creep factor.
But it was, a devil movie, too. So funny, I've got devil movies on the brain today for some reason. Imagine that. House of
the
Devil.
What about you? When was the first time you ever saw it?
I don't think... When it came out, I would have been too young. What was the rating on this movie? Do you remember?
I do not. I thought it was PG because it may have been R because they said they would have gotten an X if they did a couple of things effects-wise. that they didn't do.
You know what? It is. It was rated R. So I wouldn't have been able to go see it. I was in sixth grade. I would have been around 11 years old. So the first thing I remember about this movie is that since I couldn't see it, I read the novelization. So I had a copy of a worn paperback I got probably at some used bookstore that David Seltzer wrote. Or it was based on the David Seltzer screenplay. I'm not sure if he actually wrote the novel or not. So, and that's probably my first memory. Also, I think other people I knew saw it and told me things. Very similar to Halloween. Before I saw Halloween, people were basically telling me the scenes in the movie. But it lived up to what I anticipated, for sure.
Oh, I definitely think so. I remember reading it, too, and liking the adaptation. I remember seeing all the sequels. So I saw both the, or were there two, three sequels?
There were two direct sequels. One was Damien as a teenager, and the third was Damien as an adult, which was the first movie I saw with Sam Neill in it, because he played Damien as an adult.
Right. Yeah. Perfect. Good casting, too. And I actually had trouble seeing him for years after that and not seeing Damien.
He's the devil.
That kind of smirky smile that he gets. He's the devil.
It's Black Phillip. You know. It's Black Phillip.
That sort of thing. So it's
So we mentioned Donner. We mentioned Jerry Goldsmith. David Seltzer did write the screenplay. Little did he know what a classic he had written.
Mm-hmm. Also, from a production angle, it had Stuart Baird as an editor. And Stuart Baird's one of the best editors ever.
Okay.
And he was really good in editing this particular movie.
Going back in retrospect and looking at this film as I did the other night, it's a classic 70s film. It's got that 70s film vibe of movies that we've talked about in the past, like Jaws or Chinatown or The French Connection or The Exorcist. You know what I'm saying? It's got that feel and that look.
That's in my notes, too. The coloring, the color palette they use, and the lighting are very 70s. Mm-hmm. It's a very 70s, even 70s action, you know, like when you get to French Connection and other stuff like that. It's that same kind of feel to it. They definitely didn't skimp on budget because they went to so many different countries. You got the feeling that they were going all over the place.
Right.
Globe-wise, so that was good too. That was cool.
Yeah, even when they,
but yeah, totally.
Even when it's clearly a soundstage, like that graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
which is a really good soundstage.
It's
I mean, it's really
it
good.
Is. It's just gorgeous. I just love that scene. It's just a great scene. The only other background stuff I have is the fact that this movie, very similarly to The Exorcist, has a whole litany of coincidental craziness that happened while it was being filmed. Did you read into that?
You mean it was cursed?
Yes, exactly.
I saw a little bit of research in that. I saw a little bit of that.
Okay.
Talked about, like, plane being hit by lightning or something.
Two different planes, like, were hit by lightning.
Okay.
One... I can't remember who was on them. I want to say that Seltzer was on one of them. And they were both planes flying to the UK, but separate planes. The Rottweilers at one point attacked trainers. Donner's hotel was bombed by the IRA, which was probably more of a coincidence because a lot of that was going on at the time.
Yeah.
Donner was struck by a car, but it was a freak accident where he did not get crushed, but could have potentially got crushed. Peck canceled a charter flight from Israel, and it crashed. Did you know that?
I did
not. It ended up crashing.
There was something about a beheading, though. There was something about a stunt person got killed hurt or something.
The special effects artist, John Richardson, was injured, but then his girlfriend was beheaded on a set of A Bridge Too Far, which was the movie he worked on after this. Yeah.
So carrying the curse forward. Yeah, they were all, you know, it's because they were talking about demons and Satan.
Peck, and Luke Sixes.
Prince of Darkness.
Black Phillip. Yeah, Peck canceled a flight apparently from Israel. It ended up going to a bunch of like Japanese businessmen or something, and it crashed. How would you like? I mean, that would be that would freak me out to know that I was almost on a plane that crashed.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a bridge to a key that I have, which is Fatal Attraction and all those Fatal Attraction movies. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a perfect bridge to that because this is definitely a key for those movies.
You mean Final Destination?
Because it's. Is it Final Destination?
Yeah, you said Fatal Attraction. I'm like, wait a minute.
Final Destination. You're right. Because it's that, you get off the plane, you tempt fate, and then everybody starts dying in weird ways. You know, so I think there's a lot of inspiration from this movie.
Right.
But yeah, if I had been Peck, I would have probably been a little nervous.
Yeah.
About that. Yeah.
But then there were a few other things. Apparently one day, several of the principals were in a head-on collision, and David Warner's double was injured during the cemetery scene. But there is also a lot out there about much of this being hype from the studio.
Publicity,
exactly. So who knows what is true and what is not. But some of these things are documented as far as like the plane crash and the lightning strikes. So anyway.
Right.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it seems like you couldn't fake that. I mean, you could fake some of the other stuff, but... seems like you couldn't fake those things. Mm-hmm. Casting wise, we talked about the production team so far being very good. You know, this cast is really good too.
It's a great cast.
I think Peck is really good in this part, and it kind of like it feels like it kind of like it revitalized his career.
Well, he came out of retirement to do it.
Yeah. But then he went on to do another one of my keys and everything else, like Boys from Brazil and everything else. Right. So. And Lee Remick, I'd forgotten how pretty she is and how awesome she is in this part. So she's great in it. I even like, what's her name? Miss
Billy Whitelaw. She is fantastic.
The bad nanny, which,
And I think she was even in the Harry Potter films before she died. She's been around. She's really great. Yeah. I think I looked that up. I didn't write it down though.
She might have been, but I might have to look her up then. And we're forgetting David Warner.
Actually, David Warner's
awesome.
I may be wrong about Billy Whitelaw, but she was in Hot Fuzz, that movie with the guys that did Shaun of the Dead. Yeah. I knew I saw her in something that was more recent.
Yeah, but the whole cast was pretty good. The only one I didn't really like that much was, Damien himself. But then again, he was a little kid.
Yeah. I thought he was pretty good, though.
For a while there, I kept thinking, does he even have any lines? I haven't even heard him speak. And then he says, no, daddy, no. Or whatever.
It's Black Phillip.
It's Black Phillip. Don't touch me.
As far as the cast, I don't have a lot of alternate casting, but I do have a couple of... I do have a lot of alternate casting for Gregory Peck. Gregory Peck's son had committed suicide, so they were real nervous about asking him to do it because of the subject matter, and he ended up doing it. Before they asked him... They talked to Charlton Heston. These are all going to be 70s types. Roy Scheider.
Mm-hmm.
William Holden, who ended up doing the sequel with Lee Grant. They all turned it down. But the biggest name that cracks me up that turned it down, you're going to love this, was Dick Van Dyke. And he said it was a...
I don't know.
He said it was a really stupid decision on his part. So he kind of regretted it. But it would have been interesting.
Possibly. I could understand that. But, I don't know. But
And then at one time, Warner Brothers, I guess, was doing it. Who did this movie? Did Warner Brothers do this movie? I don't...
20th Century.
Yeah. At one time, Warner Brothers was attached, and they were grooming it for Oliver Reed, which, I could easily see that. he would have been a British ambassador to America, maybe. But
one of my watch notes that was interesting was this was 20th century, but they didn't play the music. It was totally silent at the beginning when they were showing the 20th century logo. And I thought, wonder why. I wonder if that was something Donner requested or, you know.
Well, because it starts with those low chants. So maybe they didn't want to go from the loud music to the low chants.
Yeah. That makes sense. From that la, 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 la. Yeah.
So anyway, Gregory Peck ended up doing the movie. It brought the movie the clout it needed to get extra money to hire Goldsmith, to hire Lee Remick, got David Warner on board, who was pretty popular in England, not as popular in America. But Donner specifically wanted David Warner for some movie he saw him do in the 60s, I think. And then the only other really interesting casting note I have is that Richard Donner, they call him Dick Donner. Dick Donner, I like I know him. Dick Donner was doing
you and Dick hanging out.
A television movie with Jack Palance. I cannot remember the name of it. And when Jack found out that he was going to go do The Omen in England, he said, oh, you got to look up my daughter. She's a great actress. And he did. And he cast her as the nanny who hung herself. Her name is Holly Palance. That is Jack Palance's daughter.
I did not know that. That's some cool stuff.
Yeah,
there.
Jack Palance, our favorite. Jack Palance, Henry Silva. Yeah. What other B movie actor can I name? I don't know. Anyway.
Definitely.
So, yeah, Damien, it's all for you was Holly Palance.
That was good. That was a good death, too, though. It came so unexpectedly when it
Came. And it's a good segue, because if we're going to talk about scenes, there are so many great scenes in this movie. And that is one of them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Even the montage works for me in this. When they're doing the happy montage, you know, when they move to England and it's all about right before this scene, and they're doing the whole them walking and then just snapshots. I did have a question, and maybe you remember it from the novel, or maybe you knew it from research, but the paparazzi is huge at the beginning of this movie. And is that so we have credibility for David Warner's character or something? I mean, why is there so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a perfect.
So many photographers.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect relation to the story, because all of a sudden a photographer becomes integral to the plot, because the omen per se that he is seeing are shadows in his photography around people's deaths. See him take a picture of that nanny, and then later on, of course, you see the developed picture, and there's the dark image of the noose around her neck. He ends up taking a picture of the priest with the slanted shadow going towards him. He ends up getting impaled by a lightning rod off of a church. I'm trying, you know, in describing these things, I'm actually describing scenes again. I love the scene where the priest is caught up in the storm, and he knows something's going down, and he's freaking out, running around in that wind. Even though you can see the sun shining just a tad, it looks like he is in a freak weather storm. Runs up to the church for sanctuary. The church door is locked. He can't get in. He hears lightning. He looks up, and all of a sudden, he's impaled by the church's lightning rod.
Yeah, all three of the major deaths are great in this. His death is great. Lee Remick's injury is great, and her death, but definitely the injury. I mean, I remember that when I was a kid, with the whole goldfish bowl slowly going in slow motion down away from the camera and crashing.
Yeah, that's an interesting shot.
Her having the semi, Hitchcock shot. You know, it's like Arbogast falling down the stairs in Hitchcock. I mean, in Psycho.
Yeah, I have a story about that if you don't know it.
Sure.
Apparently, Lee Remick, it is rumored, was friends with Ellen Burstyn, and she found out about Ellen getting injured on the set of The Exorcist. Remember, and we talked about
because
this.
Because of that pullback. Yeah.
With our, our podcast, when William Friedkin was not, you know, he was a little bit careless when it came to the actors, and he allowed Burstyn to get injured. She hurt her tailbone, and she claims she's still having problems with it to this very day with her back. So Lee said they were trying to talk Lee into doing the stunt, and she would drop to a mattress or to something she would fall on, you know, and she just said no. She would not do it. They were going to have to figure out another way to do it. So Donner filmed the bowl, the fish bowl first, and he didn't want to damage, you know, any real fish. So they painted sardines orange and put them in that water and let the bowl drop and crash. So it gives you that feeling of depth and of, you know, falling. Then they took the floor and made it vertical, and they made the palm fronds of the plant, they wired them so they would be going, instead of drooping down, they would be drooping, they would be going up to give you the illusion that you're still looking at the floor when you're actually looking at the wall. And they put her on a crane and just took her sideways to the wall. And then she flips, and then they cut, and of course she's lying on the floor with blood coming out of her mouth. So, but that was all because she refused to do the stunt. He had to get creative.
That's cool.
And it's a great shot.
But that's a good way. I think that's a good, it's a memorable scene. It works really well. The fact that Damien does it with a tricycle means a lot. You know, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned already the whole cemetery scene. Is great, from the reveal to the graves to the attack with the dogs. All of that is good stuff.
Yeah, and it's not only the reveal that the mother was a dog or a jackal and not even human. It's the reveal that the son was never born still. The son was murdered.
Oh, yeah. Love that. That zoom in on his skull being crushed.
Yeah, it's just horrible.
Everything is going,
And then as soon as he sees it, you know, you hear those dogs start growling, and the whole cemetery is full of Rottweilers, and you're like, holy shit. And they were going to use German Shepherds, but they couldn't get them through quarantine fast enough, and Rottweilers are native to England, so that's how they ended up with those kind of dogs, too. I did read that as well.
Well, you know, I mean, I think they're the epitome of, you know, a key for me is they're the epitome of hellhounds. They, I think from then on, they were, you know, everybody knew of them as demon dogs. You know, you had to be careful. Yeah.
Although they did get popular after the film and people started raising them.
You know, more people needed demon dogs.
I guess. You know.
I do think there were some. Well, let's see. Let's continue on the good stuff. So, of course, the whole scare factor of the nanny fight. All of that's really good and pretty good timing with all of that fight and the way it goes. And then, of course, everybody remembers the final two scenes: him in the church, and then the very last scene at the graveside, the very last shot.
And that there's a you story know, to that as well. It's so funny that you bring it up. Originally,
I tried to set you up for this.
Well, originally the final scene was going to be three caskets and the entire family was dead. But they did a screening, and I can't remember who the honcho at the studio was that got him the money. Oh, maybe it was Ladd. It may have been Ladd.
Alan Ladd Jr., same guy that also is the reason that we have Alien.
Right. If it wasn't him, it was somebody at the studio. I can't remember exactly. But he just kind of looked over at Donner and said, what if the kid doesn't die? And Donner just looked at him and said, that's brilliant. And he went back and he shot that scene. And they said that the little kid was a terror to work with. I don't know. But that's one of the reasons why Donner wanted him, because of the scenes where he gets kind of violent. And he basically dared the kid not to smile. He said, don't you laugh. Don't you laugh. And that's where he got that little evil smile from the kid at the end, because he's trying to restrain it. And of course, you know, it spawned sequels, which would also have been an ulterior motive for whoever that executive at the studio was too, I'm sure. So, But it is a great ending. Fantastic ending.
Yeah, it definitely set up a franchise, you know, for 20th Century. So definitely, that was a good decision. And I don't think we would have been, even if he had succeeded and then he'd been killed, I don't think we would have gotten as much of an oomph at the end of it as we got when, you know, they show that Damien lived and the two of them died. So I think that was a good
idea. Well, yeah, because you had the whole movie is convincing the father that he has to kill him. And then right at that moment when he's going to do it, he gets shot and the kid lives anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's great irony. It's like Robert Block irony, or, you know, for lack of another writer.
Oh, I skipped over a scene that I do like, which is in the monastery, the whole creepy burned father. That's the burned priest kind of scene. That's a really creepy scene, too. That's a good one.
I like anything to do with Mrs. Baylock. Didn't we do a Star Trek episode with a Baylock alien?
Well, Baylock. Baylock is the Corbomite maneuver. Yeah.
But I love, after the first nanny dies, Mrs. Baylock is sent from the service, or so she's told, Lee Remick, that, and she hands her references. But Billy Whitelock is, they didn't originally want to play her as that evil, but she was just so damn good at it that they just let her do it. They just let her roll.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. She's crazy.
Yes, I love it when she's like saying, oh, he's too young to go to church. He won't understand that kind of stuff. And Lee Remick is not having it. She's right back at her. You have my son ready.
Right.
And you will have him in the car in 5 minutes. I'm like, damn, man. Showdown between these women, and you know one of them's evil. So.
And then later on when he goes, Mrs. Baylock, I told you to get rid of that dog. You know, and she's like, he's gone, sir.
And I'm like, hasn't it been days? You know, and yeah, didn't you just tell her to get rid of it the day following? Yeah, I'm like, why is that damn dog still there?
Let's see, the dog's going out now.
Yeah.
There are a couple of things that I'm not great, that I didn't like about it. And I'll just say those. One, again, it had that very 70s, our blood is way too red, sort of blood when you see it a couple of times.
Yeah, you see it come out of Lee Remick's mouth when she's on the floor.
Yeah, lots of mouths, lots of coming out of mouths. But like even with the, you know, the dog fight, the blood even on their clothes and everything else is like, you know, uncomfortably red. That was my second one was, I'm sorry, if three dogs are chewing at you, especially big Rottweiler dogs, you're not just going to go leaping over fences and walk off and just hang out at the hotel that night. You know, I mean, you're going to have like shred things and stitches and it's not going to be fun.
And you know, get him, he got like his arm impaled by the arrow point of that fence, that too, man. That had to hurt.
Yeah, that too. And I was going, no. And then the only other one I really have is they do such a great job at the beginning with all the mood and the way they do it and everything. And then suddenly they get to that one scene after the priest is dead. And it's like, and now it's time for exposition hour. We'll just be listening to David Warner for the next 15 minutes while he tells us the entire backstory. You know, and it's like, okay, I wish they could have found a more clever way to do that. But
yeah, I can't think of the monk's name that they go to get the knives. I think it starts with a G. Yeah.
The one that's in Medici or wherever he's in.
He's like in the Middle East. He's like in Jerusalem or somewhere. Yeah, and that scene to me, I didn't remember it being such a stark transition. I was like, wait a minute, we're here and there's no introduction to this guy at all? That kind of bothered me a little bit.
Yeah.
But that's when he's telling him what he has to do to kill him.
Right, and where the knives have to go and all that. But that one didn't bother me. I thought that was just a continuation. I knew we were going to eventually get there because that's what the priest told him to do. You know, go to the town of Medici and see what's his name, or, you know, or Megiddo and see what's his name. But the whole scene in the priest's room, his apartment, and then later on in the photo studio. I just thought those were so bulky of... And let me tell you the whole backstory. And then, by the way, throughout our world tour of Rome and Jerusalem from now on, I'm going to be reading from the Bible and telling you some other stuff. It's like, okay. I wish we had come up with something different than that. But, you know, again, you had to back then. That's like when we were talking about Wicker Man, you know, and he learns everything he needs to learn at the library in like an afternoon, you know.
It's funny that you mentioned the Bible. David Seltzer has gone on record to say that he has never read the Bible and that most of that stuff he made up, including that poem.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is pretty funny because the poem is what you remember a lot from this film. It's kind of like the Wolfman that we did earlier this year. You know, that poem.
Yeah, I did have a...
Sticks with you.
I did find that quote from Seltzer where he says, the only reason he wrote it was strictly for the money. And he, quote, I find it horrifying how many people really believe in this silliness. I thought that was interesting.
Well, and I mean, and like we were talking about the satanic cult movies of the early 70s to mid 70s, this movie kind of started a roll of Satan movies too, but more like the satanic children movies or what have you, offspring movies or whatever. Actually, it was probably started with Rosemary's Baby now that I think about it.
Yeah, but this was a good, what, 8 years after Rosemary?
Yeah.
So, it was. You know, I think it's interesting. I think that would make a great double feature because you're looking at it from two different perspectives. One's from, like, the mother's point of view, and the other one's from, like, the father's point of view.
Well, maybe.
I think that's kind of cool. That would be a cool double feature.
Yeah, I may put it on the list for next year, or next season, that is. Devil Babies. Before we leave scenes, I think we should talk about the beheading scene, because it is one of the most famous beheading scenes ever in cinema history.
Yeah,
and it takes place shortly after the scene we were just talking about where he goes to get the knives. Robert Thorne has second thoughts and says, this is crazy. They're asking me to kill a kid. I'm not going to do it. He slings the knives, and David Warner looks at him incredulously and says, well, if you're not going to do it, then I will. And he goes to get the knives. And I don't know if you read or heard Donner talk about the filming of this scene, but he wanted to shock people, similar to like the scene in Jaws where the head pops out of the boat. But he said they did some research and they counted how long scare scenes last. And he said you can generally count to three. One, two, three. And then it's safe to open your eyes again because most people are not looking. So they purposefully made this scene 5 seconds long so that people would see it. Did you know that?
Makes sense. I did not, but that's pretty cool.
And at first, I can't remember, they couldn't make it look real. It wasn't going to be the way it was. I can't remember how it was originally set up. But then they realized when they made it a sheet of glass, the head would have to roll on the glass for extra seconds. And that's how it ended up being a truck coming out of gear and backing up and hitting something and the sheet of glass sliding off and taking David Warner's head to the sky.
Clean off.
And you know, there's no blood. What you see is wine. There's apparently a lot of wine in the back of that truck as well or something. I can't remember. But it's a pretty clean cut with not much blood at all. And then you see the reflection of it in the glass at the end.
Yeah, it's mostly the whole slow motion flip, you know, of it going up and everything else. Yeah.
And it was prophesied in a photograph that he had shown Richard Thorne or Robert Thorne earlier when he says, why are you so invested in this? And then he just shows in that picture and it's himself that he took of himself in a mirror and there's a dark shadow across his neck. The Omen.
Yeah, it's my story too or whatever. Yeah. Definitely.
Creepy shit, man. It's just really good stuff. It's Black Phillip. It's Black Phillip.
Now, let me ask. So did the novelization came out after the movie, or was this based on a novel? He wrote it for the screen?
No. Yeah, it was based. It was a screenplay first. and then there was a novelization. But I think Seltzer may have done the novelization. I cannot remember. I used to have that book, and I remember seeing his name on it.
Well, I like, you know, kind of like the way good franchises used to work, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, before it became tentpole franchises. But, you know, you would look at a trilogy, or maybe four, or maybe five if you wanted to be Planet of the Apes, but trying to tie them all together in really clever, unique ways. And I think this is one of the better ones that does that. You know, you basically see Damien at three critical stages of his life.
Mm-hmm. But the third one is kind of out there. They have like this James Bond edition of like monks that are out to assassinate him. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like mobilized monks kind of thing. Yeah, the monk militia.
Exactly. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I do remember liking it for what it was.
But if you read like Angels and Demons or some of the other, the Da Vinci Code, you know, some of those, when they start talking about, what's the name of that group? Dei, I can't remember. Angus Dei? The group of essentially militant monks, that's what they are. And they've essentially taken on the mantle of, like, the Knights Templar, and their job is to, you know, protect the Holy Roman Vatican secrets and all of that. That kind of makes, it kind of works for the omen. You know, naturally you would want to prevent the Antichrist. So.
Oh, I just found a note that I had written before. I watched a documentary about the making of this with Richard Donner and Jerry Goldsmith and David Seltzer. But before I watched that, I had this jotted down. So this must have been from IMDb. But it says that the MPAA is responsible for the Down B ending because they deemed killing a child too shocking. So there's another reason why the ending could have possibly changed.
I did read that... Jerry Goldsmith didn't even go to the Oscars this year because he had been nominated so many times and lost.
He had been nominated 11 times or something. Yeah.
That's
just crazy. And he's so funny in that documentary I was telling you about. Because he was like, yeah, I wasn't going. There's no way.
I have in my notes the chemistry between Lee Remick and Gregory Peck is awesome.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. I mean, you really feel like they're married. They care for each other. They love each other. Mm-hmm. When they both get scared, you can feel it. It's really well done. Really, and well filmed for especially for a television director to be able to then film it to that scale. That was good.
Yeah. Yeah, they put some money into this movie. It looks gorgeous. It really does. Back to Peck, I read that he took a salary cut in exchange for 10% of the gross. And it's the highest he ever made for a film.
Well, it was the highest grossing movie in 76 when it was released. I knew that.
I have that written down somewhere. But it was the fifth highest grossing film of the year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the Vatican opposed it.
Well, duh. I wonder why.
It's a devil baby.
That's a devil movie.
I've got a few other awards here. We already mentioned that it was an Oscar winner for Best Score, Jerry Goldsmith. It was a nominee for Golden Globe for Best Debut, Harvey Stevens. The little child that played Damien. I didn't know they did Best Debuts back then, but I guess they did.
I guess they did.
And then Billy Whitelaw was nominated for a BAFTA, which makes sense because she's British, for Best Supporting Actress. Yes. And Entertainment Weekly has ranked it the 14th scariest movie of all time. Which is kind of
funny. Don't know if it's that high up, but it definitely is scary. Oh, it definitely is something
got its
that
moments.
Is tense. I love the casting of both of the priests in this, too. I've got that in my notes. I remember the first, you know, the first priest, I forgot his name, Brennan or Brandon or whatever.
Are you talking about the one that gets burned?
No. the one that, okay, so yeah, go back. No, he's essentially the first priest. Now let's go back to the warning priest, the first priest that, you know, talks to Thorn. Such a great face. He has like a big hawk nose and his eyes are kind of squinty and, you know, he's just a really great
face. That's Father Brennan. I think he's played by Patrick Troughton is his name. The one that gets impaled.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Such a great face. I mean, he's like, he looks like almost like a sneaky face. It's great.
He reminds me of Sam Waterston a little bit, only a little darker.
I can see that a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see that. And then the other priest was cool, but just because of the burn makeup, I just thought he had a neat face as well.
I think his name is Father Spoleto. I have it written down, but I don't have a picture to go with it. Yeah, his name is Martin Benson. He's a lot younger in this picture than he was in that makeup, so it's a little bit off to me. But anyway.
Right.
And then there's a monk. Or maybe he's the monk I'm thinking of, too. I don't know. Whatever.
No, the monk was the one that guides them through everything. You know what I mean? He's the one that helps them, I think, through the...
Well, he's got a real memorable look, too.
Yeah, he does. With that cut and everything, mm-hmm. the haircut the way it is. Yeah, I could see that. I did get freaked out because I was kind of looking down, taking a note, and all of a sudden I heard him say, Horton? And I looked up and went, what? And it took me a few scenes to realize that his servants, the Thorns' servants, were the Hortons. It was Mr. and Mrs. Horton. It was like his butler and his maid or whatever.
That's hilarious. Horton, get
so I kind of got kind of super scared there. It was like, wait, Gregory Peck just called me by name. I need to stop looking at my notes.
One thing I was going to mention earlier when we talked about Holly Palance's suicide as the initial nanny at the birthday party. Love that iconic shot with Lee Remick looking up and how they use that forever and ever on every bit of publicity material that you can get with this movie, including the one I'm looking at right now.
Oh, yeah. Her eyes, mm-hmm. beautiful. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's iconic.
Oh, yeah. Such great expression on her face. I mean, yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm. Really good.
So are we heading into the land of Keys?
Let's go to Keydom.
Well, I will give you the first and biggest key.
Okay. Better be the biggest.
The Bible.
Better be the big... the Bible.
There you go.
I did not have that one, but that was, I can't believe I didn't. And thank you so much for the for the delivery.
Oh my God. It's Black Phillip. It's Black Phillip. Yep.
I would agree. I think that's a good key. Yeah.
So there you go. You're next.
I had one from earlier. Bad Seed, of course.
Yes.
The whole story of the evil child, mm-hmm. Or a child that seems to, you know, be just inherently evil. Although Damien doesn't, I get the impression in this that Damien doesn't manipulate it any of this because he's vulnerable. He doesn't really know.
He's got caretakers.
You know, they kind of set it up as, mm-hmm. yeah, he's got people protecting him and taking
Dogs.
Care of everything. Or yeah. even his dad, you know, throwing... lightning rods off of church, sort of thing. We've already mentioned two of my keys, which are Boys from Brazil and Exorcist, of course, uh-huh. Because I think both were influential, both forward and backward of this movie.
Yeah, we've already mentioned one of mine too, which would be Rosemary's Baby. Yep. It's Damien at an even younger age; he's just being born, basically.
Yeah.
And Roman Polanski is very memorable.
A key that gets me still, and I brought it up, I think, on a couple of our demonic podcasts, is The Sentinel that came out a few years later, which, again, is that whole Satan is being born somewhere and you have to watch out for him sort of story. Along the lines of the Johnny Depp one, Ninth Gate, I had that one too. There wasn't really a scene that reminded me of it, but just that thematic of, you know, a devil, the devil's reign on earth kind of thing.
I want to mention one that you already mentioned that I had not even thought of, because I've never read this. I've always heard it's a big joke, but I've seen the trailers for the films, and I can see where they have to be related, and it's The Da Vinci Code. Those kind of movies are born out of this too, aren't they?
Well, sort of. I think Angels and Demons is much more
Raiders of the Lost Ark
of this one. No, Raiders of the Lost Ark is probably more similar to Da Vinci. Da Vinci's more similar.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
Angels and Demons is more similar to this because it really does deal with the Illuminati and killer monks who are trying to manipulate the world.
We got to do that movie, man.
Monk assassins.
Killer monks.
Yeah, killer monks.
Killer monks on Werewolf Island.
On Werewolf Island. That would be perfect. Yeah. I've got... I had two that I thought of when I was watching it. One was The Nanny, the movie, The Nanny, which is about the evil nanny. And the other one, which is The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, which is a movie about an evil nanny. And it's not necessarily that the nanny in this is evil. It's just that, you know, the nanny plays an important role in this.
Right. So, I mean, I have...
Yeah, inspired these evil nannies.
I have a list that just keeps growing in my head, and I can't translate them all to paper fast enough, but like two of the other Antichrist type devil movies that come to mind are one called the Seventh Sign. Didn't Demi Moore do one? And it ends up it ends up not being the devil. That it may end up being an angel or something. I can't remember. God damn, these things.
No, it was Apocalypse, because it was the seven seals were being broken.
Yes,
which signals the end of the
and
world.
And Jürgen Prochnow was in it too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was the main lead.
Right, and then there was a movie with Martin Sheen called The Believers. Wasn't that like a devil movie too?
That one I haven't seen.
I just remember a spider comes out of some chick's face in that movie. It freaked me out.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mentioned earlier today that I had just watched House of the Devil, and that movie deals with someone being impregnated with the spawn of Satan as well.
Okay, then.
Yeah, so I told you, I'm on a devil kick.
Obviously, you are.
I am. I have one other key besides all these movies that we know about that we're not mentioning. God, I could keep going. I'm not going to, though.
Mm-hmm.
I read that Neil Gaiman said that his book and now Amazon series, Good Omens, was a direct spawn of this movie. He said this movie inspired him to write that book. So,
oh, yeah. That makes perfect sense.
So any of you Neil Gaiman fans out there, that lighthearted, apocalyptic fantasy, whatever it is, I haven't watched it, was spawned from this movie as well.
I wonder if it could have spawned, like, do you remember the, it was a comic, a graphic novel, but then they've turned it into, I think, a couple of other series, or I think Constantine, where the guy's a demon hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Wonder if that was inspired by this at all.
Oh, I'm sure. And what about that Lucifer television show? Remember that? I mean, like I said, there's a million of them, and we could keep pulling them out of our ass, but we'd be here all day. I was just trying to throw some out there because there's so many of them.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So if y'all have any people listening out there, you key holders, and you want to throw some our way that we may have blatantly overlooked, please do. You'll probably
definitely
generate even more vomiting of satanic films. You never know. Yeah,
demon priests, demon sons of demons,
demon children, demon cults. I'm sure there was an American Horror Story. There's got to be one. One of those was a devil one, I'm sure.
I'm sure there was. So. Definitely. Cool. Well, as we sum up, of course, for all you guys out there listening, thank you so much for listening to us. This is one of our favorites, obviously, if you can't tell. We both like this a lot. Recommend it. Go out and get your... your evil religious. That was in my notes too. There, I think there is, maybe it's just me, but it can't be because, you know, there's been franchises and movies and everything else. But I think there is the same way people are afraid of zombies, are afraid of being eaten by something or, you know, whatever, this whole religious allegory, devil rising kind of fear, I think is palpable to me. You know, you and I have talked about The Exorcist is still to me the scariest movie I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. This movie is not near as scary as that, but it still unnerved me. It bothered me still. And I don't know why. I think I've got this thing about religious.
Well, this one in particular places it in the world of politics, which is kind of creepy when you think about it.
True. And the corollary of politics, of politics being the best place for a demon to rise.
Mm-hmm. And Damien ends up in the care of the United States president, which is kind of odd. I think they ended up being like brother-in-laws or something. But he was somehow related to the British ambassador, and that's how he ends up with custody.
There's a line earlier on where she says you guys like went to school together.
Yeah.
So I think it's like a godfather kind of
thing.
That
may be it.
He kind of adopted him or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with that. Cool. Definitely go listen to it. Go watch it. I mean, listen to us, but watch it.
Get your devil on.
And definitely give us a like or a review or a 4-star or something on there on your favorite podcast app of choice. Thank you for listening.
This is our countdown to the end of the season, too, by the way. 3 episodes to go, and they are all double features.
You're going to love them.
Yep.
They're awesome.